Welcome back to the Mental Perk Podcast, where we focus on real people, real issues, and real talk. I'm Carla Hutcherson, a licensed professional counselor and the director for the Hannah Hope Foundation.
And I'm Brandy Mock, executive board member for the Hannah Hope Foundation.
We are here to talk about all things mental health, whether it's daily stress, academic pressure, work and career issues, managing a diagnosis, or suicidal and self-harm behaviors. We want this to be a space of honest talk that helps to destigmatize perceptions surrounding mental health issues.
Today we have Lauren Detlefs, a family practice PA for almost 10 years out of Prosper, Texas. How are you doing, girl?
I am fantastic.
How awesome. Doing good, doing good.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad you're here. Tell us a little bit about you.
So, grew up in the Grapevine, South Lake area. I've actually been a practicing PA for 13 years, but I've been in family practice for 10. The first 3 years of my career, I was in the emergency room in urgent care, and then, you know, hours all over the place, and started having kids and decided we needed a schedule, so went to the family practice side of things, and I'm loving my 8-to-5.
Yes, I can imagine. I'm waiting for the days that I can work 8-to-5.
We are too.
All right. Well, Lauren, we are going to talk a lot about kind of your practice and how you've seen the changes in mental health and the trends in mental health and that how that's affecting your patients and what trends you've really seen in your practice.
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's more of a topic than I think people either want to admit or actually just do admit, but it's everywhere. I mean, every patient that comes in to see me, whether it's diabetes, high blood pressure, a med check for, you know, anything, even if it's their stimulants or just I've got a sore throat, we always screen and say, hey, how are you feeling mental health-wise? We always do an alcohol screen, and a lot of times that can lead us towards finding the mental or identifying the mental health patients because a lot of people self-medicate and don't realize you're self-medicating with alcohol.
So you do a depression screening on every patient?
So not a full, like, PHQ-9 type screen, but just a few questions of, hey, are you happy? Are you doing okay? Do you have anything else you want to talk about? Is it truly just a headache, or do you have a headache because you've been in bed for 4 days because you're depressed?
Yeah.
You know, and really, if you look, you find it. And I think a lot of people are scared to ask the questions because they know that if you start asking questions, you're going to get answers that either you don't want to hear or you're not prepared to hear. And a lot of people aren't real comfortable with opening up about mental health.
Yes, I was going to want, I mean, does that kind of do some patients shut down when
completely
you ask this question?
Totally, yes, they do. Or they'll go, oh, no. My culture, we don't believe in mental health, or we don't believe in depression, or no. I just, that's not something we're allowed to say.
Yeah.
Or there's a big stigma.
How do you re-educate those patients?
So I always kind of use different medical diagnoses and put it as an example to mental health.
Okay.
I say, okay, so if you have a diabetic, are you going to say, oh, no, sorry, we don't believe in diabetes, I'm not going to take my insulin? I mean, you can't look at someone and go, we'll stop being diabetic.
Yeah, right? That's an example that we use all the time. People understand that depression, anxiety are medical conditions.
Absolutely.
It's not a choice. It's not I'm just being moody or dramatic or any of those things. It is literally
a chemical imbalance
of the brain. And it's how your brain is processing and functioning. And it's something that you can treat very easily.
Yes.
We've got a lot of things, not
Absolutely.
Always easily, but we, there's a lot of things that we can do to treat
there's
it.
There's a lot of options.
Yes. And so, and I think some people just think they have to live with it, and they don't, you know?
Yeah.
It'd be surprising to me to find out what a percentage of doctors that actually do a screening on new patients when they come in. You know, I mean, I think it's awesome that that's a part of your practice, but a lot of doctors don't. And then there's that education of educating these people and going, hey, it's not your choice to feel this way. And then you go through the steps of educating or just giving them a simple example of, you know, diabetics, they have to have medication, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think hospitals are doing the training of, you know, doing those screenings for every patient that comes through the ER. I don't know that private offices are doing it as much as the hospitals are.
Well, and I think there's a, not fear, but to a lot of family practice providers of, oh, if you open the door and now I have to talk to you about it. Or now I'm liable because you told me this and I can't just go, oh, no, just kidding. I didn't mean to ask you that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But, oh, crud, well, you told me this. So now
I got to do something,
about,
do
something it. About it. Because then if you don't, and God forbid something happens down the road, I mean, you're liable.
Do you think, like, PAs, you've been through the school as well as doctors, do you feel like they're getting enough training in mental health diagnosis and treatment?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And honestly, we don't have a good screening tool. I've asked for one for several years. My company clinic used to have a great screening tool. And it was on an iPad, and it was just about 20 to 30 questions, and it screened for depression, anxiety, bipolar, ADHD, PTSD. It was fantastic. That company actually went under, and we lost that tool, and there's literally nothing to replace it with. We have the PHQ-9, but it's 10 questions, and
it's not enough.
It's not nearly enough.
Yeah. Wow.
So that would be something fantastic that we need as a great resource. I mean, we can print things off online all day long and check the box, yes or no, but to actually ask the real questions that say, okay, is this anxiety or is this depression? I show a lot of my stimulant patients, and there's something called the ADHD iceberg.
Okay.
And on the top, above the iceberg, the part of the iceberg you see is what you think ADHD is. It's trouble concentrating or inability to sit still. But the bottom of the iceberg is depression and anxiety and difficulty holding a job and restlessness and insomnia. So there's so many things in mental health that come together. Depression might be because of an anxiety situation or anxiety is because of an uncontrolled ADHD. So unless you have the right tool to diagnose exactly what you're treating, sometimes you end up treating the symptom and not the root cause.
Yeah, and most mood disorders do come with a comorbid diagnosis of some sort.
Absolutely, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, 100%. So we know 1 in 4 adults struggle with mental health diagnosis. And we also know in 2023, at least 42%, there's a rise, 42% of adults are struggling with mental health issues. So are you seeing kind of those numbers trending up?
Absolutely.
Do you think, what do you think is kind of causing that trend? Do you think it's playing off of the pandemic and people kind of unthawing from something that we've never been through before?
I do. I absolutely think we had a big rise after 2020 because majority of the world was home for 12 to 18 months. And all of a sudden we have people that are used to being in companies and clinics and workspaces surrounded by other people and having people to conversate with to being stuck in their house. And so weight gain became a huge epidemic in 2020. And so did mental health because people didn't understand that that was what was creeping in. So now they're coming in saying, well, I'm just sad or I'm just tired. I just want to sleep all the time. But come to find out, it's just an underlying depression.
Exactly.
But when you put that word to it, people freak out about the word depression.
And they don't want a diagnosis.
No. Yeah. And they're like, oh, no, don't put that in my chart because then that's going to mean that I'm on medication. But I always tell people, look, you're not going to walk out of my clinic with a big sign on your head that says, I'm on a medication for depression.
Yeah.
No one's going to know unless you tell them.
Right.
But I also think there's a big shift, especially this year I've seen, in self-care. Mm-hmm. And with that's coming a lot of mental health changes, like with the HER online, and that you can call and get online counselors now. So there's kind of that push to acknowledge and call a spade a spade.
Yeah. 100%. But and there's lots of different ways to treat depression and anxiety. And some of that is medication. Sometimes it's hard for the counseling to work because the fog is so heavy over your brain that you need the medication to help the therapy be a little bit more effective. And so just really the psychoeducation around that. Do you feel like you have that enough in your office? Do you have the time to give that kind of psychoeducation?
I feel like I do, but it's because I have an amazing support staff. Yeah. And so within my clinic, we have what we call pods. And I'm in my own pod by myself, and I have two nurses that work with me. And, I mean, they've been with me for 3 years now, so they know me very well. They know the questions. They anticipate what I'm going to ask and what I'm going to end up talking about. So they're able to kind of schedule patients accordingly in blocks to give me that time. And even though my appointments are booked in 15-minute slots, I'm never really out of a room in 15 minutes. I mean, if you want to talk to me about mental health, then we're going to hold hands and cry together. I'm not going to say, oh, sorry, your time's up.
Yes.
Allow me to move on.
Yes.
Come back next week. No, I mean, I'm going to take the time you need because it's so important to me that these people feel seen and understood, because I think if they don't, they're not going to open up to anybody else. So you don't know who's getting out of their comfort zone to kind of put a little tiny baby step out there to see how it's going to be well received. And if it turns off with me, they may not ever tell anybody else ever again. Mm-hmm.
That's very true. And I've heard that from patients who have taken years off from therapy that they needed because a therapist didn't interact with them with that compassion and with that empathy.
Yeah.
And it's such an important part of being a healthcare provider.
Absolutely. The provider is, it's not just, you're not a diabetes doctor, you're not a hypertension, you're a whole body person. I always quote the Patch Adams quote, which is my absolute all-time favorite, that I try to really focus my practice on, is if you look at the disease, you don't actually see the whole person, but if you focus on the person itself, you're going to win every time. If you focus on just a disease, you win, you lose. But if you focus on the person, you win no matter what. Mm-hmm. Even exactly. if they end up with a fatal condition, you still treated the person. You can't just look at it as an ailment. It is a person.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's such a message today because there's so much division. And just mm-hmm. to really understand the wholeness of the person and how important that is. Sure. I think it's
and
such a great
concept. And how often do you educate your patients of, hey, we put you on medication? A lot of doctors don't emphasize sometimes whenever a patient's being put on antidepressants that this is not a possible lifetime thing that you have to take.
No.
And they go through and exchange, you know, talk about the cortisol levels and how your body works. I mean, do you explain to your patients, hey, just because we're doing this right now doesn't mean this is going to be a permanent thing you have to do for your rest of your life? It may be.
Absolutely.
I mean.
And I usually tell people there are three classes of patients on antidepressants. You've got one that it's a horrible season. You just got fired from your dream job. You just went through a divorce. And you're on it for the season while you heal. And then we get you off of it. And you may never be on it ever again. Then there's the one, class two, that's on it for a season. They get off, they're okay. And then something else happens. We're back on it okay. for a season, and then they're off. And then there's those, much like myself, that
me too.
have been on medication for more than I'd like to admit, probably. And it's just who I am as a person, and I know right. that it's not a situational thing for me. And I'm very open with my patients about this. I'm an open book. And yeah. a lot of them know that. You can ask me any question and I'll answer it for you yeah. because if I'm not going to be open to you, you're not going to be open to me. Mm-hmm. But I have my absolute dream job. I'm living in my calling, amazing husband that I don't deserve, three amazing kiddos, a great church, good friends, a good support system. I have a great life. So there's zero reason for me to be depressed. I mean, just zero reason for me to be depressed other than it's a chemical reaction in my brain.
Yes.
Of I have that. It's not because of a circumstance. It's not because of a divorce mm-hmm. or a firing. It's just that's how my brain is wired. And every couple of years, I try to go off the meds just to see how I do. And mm-hmm. I find myself in a very dark place, and I get back on them. And yeah. I've come to where I'm okay with that. And that's
makes important. Me. That's important to know, though, because when people get off or when you try to transition off of that, I like to think of it as my lifeline.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's where we should change the thinking is instead of making someone think, oh, my God, I have to take this pill today. It's the only thing that's going to make me feel better. I'm like, let's take it. Let's take it.
Let's feel better.
Let's feel better. Yes. Let's yes. feel better. And then if I get to the point where I want to transition off, I make sure that I'm asking someone, mm-hmm. hey, tell me what I should expect, or even ask your doctor, hey, do you think this is smart?
What does this look like?
Yeah, what does this look like?
And really, no one out there wants to take themselves off an antidepressant. They really need the advice of a doctor because you want to make sure that it's done medically correct.
Correctly, sure. And you can't just stop the meds cold turkey. You have a lot of withdrawal symptoms. But I think one of the big things that throws people a loop is they think that an antidepressant is a happy pill. Or it's something they're just going to take and they're going to wake up tomorrow and they're going to be amazing and have all the serotonin. And
rainbows and lollipops.
Yes. Right? And riding on backs of unicorns. No. It's not.
You still got to do the work.
Yes.
You don't have the.
And that is so important for you guys. Both of y'all say this, but let's say you do put someone on medication. I don't think this is stressed enough. How long, like, they think they're going to take the pill and they wake up the next day and it's like, whoa, it's not. How long does it take for
a
medication?
Good 3 to 4 weeks to really start noticing a good actual change. And it's because these medicines aren't giving you something you don't already have.
Right.
They're allowing your body to build up what it should have, what should be there to allow you to go through these stressful events. And it's making those receptors in your brain like the neurotransmitter more. Yeah. So it's raising the affinity to it. So what's there, your body, and that's why it takes a little bit to kick in, because you've got to build, I call it the fishbowl in the brain. You got to build the fishbowl up with your neurotransmitters, and then your body can pull from it mm-hmm. to go through situations. So that's why it takes a little bit to kick in, and that's why you have to take it consistently on a daily basis.
Yeah, and all of that, you know, following those directions and making sure you're doing it just the way your medical doctor says. Because I know that people are like, oh, I'll just take it for a while, I'll feel better, and then they'll stop taking mm-hmm. it, and then they, you know, and they, but they're constantly trying to self figure out mm-hmm. how to manage the medicine.
The intentions are good. It's just, in that state, you just can't, yeah. I don't think you can understand. Mm-hmm. You want the quick fix,
mm-hmm.
but then the quick fix doesn't come and you've got to process it. And I think that processing step is skipped a lot, right? So tell me about, you're so passionate. I can hear how you're passionate about mental health. Tell me about what makes you that passion. What gives you that passion for mental health?
Oh, gosh. Well, I come from a very long family history of depression. I believe that it's very much so generational.
Mm-hmm.
And my family is very heavy in mental health, so much that I have my granddad actually took his own life because of a mental health situation. And that sticks with me because it's blood, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. it also
it hits close to home.
It does. Mm-hmm. And it hits close for me because my dad always tells me how much I look like him and how when I smile, it reminds him of him. So I feel like if the stigma wasn't there, or if people were able to talk about it more, we could help that suicide rate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, suicide is a very real thing. It's the second leading cause of death. I mean,
for 18 to 24 year olds, it's the second leading cause of death. And, you know, Brandy and I are both working with the Hannah Hutt Foundation, mm-hmm. which is educating on suicide prevention. And so we are really ingrained in suicide is preventable.
It is.
We have to talk about it.
And that's the problem is making sure someone feels like they're in the safe place where they can talk about their emotions and not be
judged.
And
it's not embarrassing.
Right.
It's not. I have a patient. God, this was probably 8 years ago. I saw her on a Friday, and she came in, and she was doing fantastic, and she took her life on Sunday.
You know, it doesn't discriminate.
Suicide
hits everybody's lives.
Exactly.
You probably don't know anyone who doesn't have a story
exactly.
of
yes.
someone in their life who has made this choice.
Or has a background with mental health.
Yeah.
I mean, and if the more we keep it in the dark, it's going to stay in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Darkness grows in darkness. Darkness cannot grow in the light. So if we cast a light on it and we take a shadow and we put a big light on it, it's no longer dark and scary.
Yeah,
it's something that we're all in together. I mean, God called us to live in community for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
We're not called to live in a dark place by ourselves because that's not going to set anybody up for success.
Well, human beings aren't meant to be alone.
No.
We weren't created to be alone. Yeah.
And in community is when you can have those real conversations. And that's my goal with my patients is, you know, if I can be that person for somebody, I want to be, because maybe they don't have that person.
Well, and that was interesting. You said we were meant to be with each other,
yes.
and it goes back to COVID.
Yes.
You know, we were not allowed to be with each other. And I remember the priority was, you know, social distancing, all this good stuff. And then you started to see the suicide rate just start to hike up. And
you're like,
at what point is our mental health more important than, you know, what we're dealing with now? Right. So it's got to be talked about.
Yes, 100%. And I think, you know, we were focusing on adults, but I really want to look at some trends with young adults. Mm-hmm. 18 to 25 years old right now are experiencing the highest mental health conditions. What do we think those trends are?
A lot of it comes from the pandemic as well. I mean, we had all these seniors that graduated in 2020 that didn't get graduations.
Yeah.
They didn't get to go to college. They didn't get to start a first job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have three young children in elementary school, and they missed kindergarten, first, and third grade.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, and yes, they're young enough, but in the ages between year 18 and year 24, those are the ones that right now are coming out of COVID.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
They were launching during that.
Yeah.
And there's so many important monument or milestones that need to be had, like walking across the stage at high school
uh-huh.
or walking into your first job and shaking hands and being nervous and mm-hmm. sitting down at your desk. I mean, those are experiences that help shape our brains. And they give chemicals good and bad.
Yes.
I mean, so when you have a lack of that experience, you have a lack of transformation that direction. So now we have, I mean, not that everyone is like this, but there are several people in that age group that feel very lost and don't mm-hmm. have direction. And then they have all these expectations from parents and peers, go get a job and do well for yourself and mm-hmm. be successful and make money. And they don't have direction there. So they end up in their own head.
Yeah.
Alone in a dark place,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
which leads to mental health.
100%. So yeah, I'm seeing that in my own private practice. I'm seeing these college age mm-hmm. young adults really struggling. They didn't get a proper launching into mm-hmm. college, and they don't know how to launch out, mm-hmm. and it's just creating worlds of anxiety.
It's scary. Yeah. Scary thinking that our kids are growing off feeling that way, right?
It's also an expectation thing. I mean, if you look at the world 30 years ago, especially being a female.
Right.
I mean, the expectation on women right now, whether you're in your 40s, your 30s, or you're 18 to 25, is get a full-time job, support your family, support your husband, support your kids, do all the things, but also take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And have self-care and sleep when the baby sleeps. But, I mean, you know, just that expectation is there of be successful, be successful, be successful. And it's stressful.
Yeah.
And it puts so much pressure on yourself. And that's when people isolate and they get anxious.
Yeah, it seems like just teaching the basic coping skills in life starting at a young age would be so important.
Yeah.
To introduce this back into schools. And I think a long time ago, schools did that. We had classes where we kind of helped prepare kids a little bit better for dealing with these things and how to handle problems and really focusing on life skills. And I don't know that we're doing that anymore.
I think, you know, it's funny. I wish that if we talked about mental health awareness as much as we do drugs, alcohol, all those other things, it would be just a normal conversation.
Correct.
But we've stigmatized it so much that it's like, it's not good. We're hoping, obviously, the trend through Hannah for Hope and through professionals like both of you, that we start to talk about it more to where it's the norm.
And that's why this platform is, we're hoping it's going to be effective in showing this is real stuff. These are real people with real issues. Mm-hmm. And so many people can relate to them. And that's what we really want to point out is you don't have to be alone in this battle. You can have support from all across the boards.
So,
there's so many ways.
Lauren, one of your favorite little quotes that I like to hear you talk about is the comic, your favorite comic strip. Tell me what you do. I mean, how you explain that to your patients.
So with patients that are really hesitant to take medications.
Right.
They're just going, no, you know, and I'm a Christian woman, so I'm all for praying and, you know, getting help from your local church and being community. But when patients are like, no, I just need to pray more, or no, I just need to spend more time on myself, or if I just need to do more self-help or self-care, and I probably say this to too many patients, but I've got a comic that I absolutely adore. And it's a guy out in the middle of the ocean and he's drowning. And he's praying for God to save him. He's like, God save me, God save me. And a boat comes by. And he goes, no, I don't need a ride. God's going to save me. A helicopter comes by. He says, no, I don't need a ride. God's going to save me. Well, he dies. And in the last box, he goes to heaven. He goes, God, where were you? He said, well, I sent you a boat and a helicopter. I mean, so help isn't always what you think it's going to be.
Yeah. Oh, I love
so
that.
So a medication can be your boat.
Yeah.
It can be your helicopter.
Absolutely.
Or TMS therapy or counseling.
Yeah.
Or I mean, I've got a daughter that does EMDR. I mean, it's fantastic. And
yes.
Just so
okay, explain EMDR. What is that to people that may not know what it is?
It's focused on trauma
and
PTSD.
Okay.
And kind of, you might be able to explain this better than me, but reprogramming bad things to be more, not be positive, because you can't make a bad situation a positive, but training the brain response to it so it's not as traumatic.
And it uses these rapid eye movements to kind of get you back in a place where you can go back to where the problem originated and kind of work your way through it.
Okay.
And create a safe space and then be able to then apply the coping skills.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Or I have a patient that I actually saw on Friday who we've been doing medications for several months, and she actually had a breaking point, had a really bad moment, went into an inpatient facility and went through a TMS procedure. And she is on the back end of it. She's 90 days out in complete remission. She's not on any medications. I mean, just fantastic. So there are lots of good options out there. Even if medication's not your boat, there is a boat, and we can find it.
Correct.
We just have to know that you need the boat first.
Yeah, and if you go back to your diabetes example, like the insulin is the tool that helps you live a normal, happy life, right? There's so many tools in mental health that can be used, whether it's medication or different kinds of evidence-based therapies, but there's something that can help. Mm-hmm. And what we know from research is that depression is treatable. And so we don't want to throw our hands in the air. We don't want to sit in this dark closet by ourselves. We want to get out there and make sure that we're getting that lifeline, that we're trying to find those things that are going to help improve our life, because everyone deserves that.
Absolutely.
Everybody deserves that.
And it's kind of like the diabetes. You can't wake up one morning and say, I'm not going to have diabetes. You can't wake up one morning and go, I'm not going to be depressed today. But the decision you do have is to get up. So my patients tell me, you may wake up and still feel depressed, but you still have to make that choice to get out of bed.
And I think a lot of people struggle with the fact of when you explain it to them in a positive way, it's not a choice to be depressed for some of these mm-hmm. people. And then it's almost like they feel defeated because they're like, I want control over this. Mm-hmm. Why is this not a choice? And then you have to go through the education process of going, the chemicals, I wish more physicians would explain it to you in layman's terms to where the patients didn't feel like it was just out there. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that's a big struggle for a lot of patients is sitting down and explaining to them.
And I think it's not a choice to get the depression. And I think it's really important for people to know the choice comes in taking back control over, I'm going to get the treatment I need. I'm not going to let the depression control me. I'm going to control how it plays its role.
Exactly. Yeah. If you have the choice to get up in the morning and make a step and make a choice.
Now, do you prepare your patients for, like, let's say they're going through a moment of depression, you start to treat them with medication, then you find that, hey, maybe we need to up your medication a little just mm-hmm. to play with it. Do you find that when they have those setbacks, it's a lot harder to get them more focused on staying, you know, focused on the end results of making them better? Or do you feel like it just, they shut down and they just don't want to do medication anymore?
I think there's a good mix of both.
Okay.
That some feel very defeated because they want the happy pill. They want to wake up tomorrow morning and feel good. And then there's those that, you know, start feeling a little bit better, but they're not all the way there yet. Then they come in and say, okay, I think it needs to be increased. And so we do. But there's some that go, well, I don't feel any better, so this must not be working, so I'm just going
to
stop.
And I think it's important to realize that not everybody responds to the same mm-hmm. antidepressant. Right. It's like my husband and I, when we have like a headache or a body ache, he loves to take Aleve. Mm-hmm. Aleve does nothing for me. I take Advil, yes. right? Because we metabolize things differently. Same thing on antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds. You're not always going to respond to each one, and you have to work with your doctor.
Yes.
Don't give up. Don't get frustrated. You have to find the one that works best for your body.
And that's where patient education comes into play.
Yeah. Because
if they don't understand that, look, the first one may not be the best one. It may take us 2 or 3 tries, but stick in there with me. We're going to find the one that works the best for you, and we're going to get you feeling better. And it's not a quick fix. I mean, what I educate my patients on is when you're on these kind of medications, I really want more of the retroactive response of you going through, you know, your day and then stopping going, huh, I really could have blown up at that person today. Or I really normally would have acted like this, but I didn't. So I must be feeling better, or I must be better in control of my surroundings or how I react to things. So it's not going to be you're going to wake up and feel like a new person, but you get in a fight with your husband or your kids and you don't yell at them and you go, gosh, I normally would have yelled then, but I didn't. And so that's the kind of response I'm looking for.
Oh, I love that too. Yeah. I mean, that you're telling them, hey, watch for these things, that you're not triggered like you used to be. Or, man, that's a great way of helping them process.
My emotional responses weren't as intense.
Yes.
That's huge.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I mean, you're still going to have your baseline of anxiety and depression. But instead of being in an 8 all the time, if we can make it or bring you down to a 2, you may still have your 8 moments, but your baseline's lower. So what I tell patients is, look, I want you to be mad, happy, sad, scared, you know, irritated, but I want you to feel like you in that moment. I don't want you to feel like a volcano that just erupted that you can't control.
And I think people feel that they're going to become numb on meds and they're not going to have emotions, right? But that's not true either. And if a medication is making you feel numb, it's not the right one.
Yes, exactly.
But a lot of people don't know to say that, though, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So knowing if it doesn't make you feel right, talk to your physician.
Then it's not the right
Let
one
Let them play
for
with.
You.
It's just like, I love the analogy of the different, you know, Aleve versus Tylenol, you know, or whatever. You guys don't respond the same way.
Correct.
It's the same thing. And that's all education. Mm-hmm. That comes from the doctor telling him, hey, this is what you should do.
I mean, feelings are good.
Yeah.
We need to have feelings.
Absolutely.
There's a function to every feeling.
Yes.
So we don't want to shut people's feelings off at all. I mean, that's not a quality of life either.
It's not. And I mean, I laugh with patients. I can sedate you all day long, but I don't think that's the quality of life that you want to have.
No.
And it's
100%.
Not what I want for you either.
Yeah.
So much good information here. And this is where that doctor-patient relationship is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have that connection with your patients, you're not going to have these kind of conversations. It's going to be, you go in, you do the standard blood pressure, look in your throat, that kind of thing, and they're out the door and you're not getting to the real bottom of the issue. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of these, psychosomatic moments where you have symptoms that could look like something else, and it may actually be a mental health issue.
Absolutely. Or especially in kids, stomach aches.
Yes.
There's a huge correlation between mental health and the gut health and the yes. gut biohealth. And a lot of kids that are, you know, staying home from school because they've got stomach aches or headaches, come to find out they're anxious.
Yeah.
And they don't want to go to school because then that triggers their anxiety. So I've got a stomach ache, thus I can't go to school.
That's interesting you bring that up. And I'm curious, as a parent and as a doctor, how do you handle these children that come in and actually do open up to you and do talk to you, but you know the parents aren't receptive to the child being put on medication?
A lot of patient education. just a lot of education and having the parent, you know, just a lot of conversations of this is what the reality is.
Right.
And even if it's an 8-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 21-year-old, when something rears its ugly head or pops up and it's enough that a parent notices it and then brings that child into a provider to get help, at that point they usually kind of have that thought in the back of their head, but a lot of them are just so against it, they won't. But that's when you can get counseling involved.
Right.
And get them to a counselor, because that's not a medication step. Let's get you into a counselor.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of patients too that come into me from their counselors and go, I've been seeing my counselor for a year. We're really making a lot of great strides, but she thinks that maybe I should look into starting on a medication.
Yeah.
So that's where having a relationship between the provider and the counselor can be really good, because mm-hmm. they can be advocates for each other when necessary.
Yeah, I think we go back to the stigma of mental health, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say a person has a counselor or doesn't have a counselor. For some reason, the word psychiatrist scares people.
Yeah.
And I do not know why, because it's a specialist of
mental health.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right. And so, but that word scares. So they're going to come in through the family mm-hmm. practice way before they go to the psychiatrist first. You know, how do you do that? What's your protocol in what you're going to handle in your office versus what you feel a psychiatrist in the referral to the psychiatrist is going to need to be important?
So a lot of times I will start with me. Of, you know, let's get you on a medication, let's see how we can get you feeling, and if, you know, one or two meds in, they feel great, we're doing fantastic, I keep them in-house. If we've tried a few things, we're just not getting where we want to be, they're getting worse, that's when I would make the referral to psychiatry.
Okay.
Of just if it's more, and that's the same with any specialty. I mean, my patients with back pain,
yeah.
I'll keep you in-house, I'll do the trigger points, we'll do muscle relaxers, we'll, you know, do physical therapy, do as much as we can. But when it becomes more than I can manage and you need further care, I'm going to refer you to an orthopedic or a neurosurgeon. It's the same with psychiatry. If this yeah. becomes to where I have, because I'm not a specialist.
You kind
I'm
of exhausted what you
yes,
can do.
Yes, I've exhausted what I'm comfortable with and what's known in my wheelhouse. That's when I refer out.
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. And this is a lay question to you professionals here, which is, you know, the lay person here. Is there a magic blood test you could do? Like, is there any blood work you could do on patients to check levels to see if something's off that would indicate that there should be a medication change, like your serotonin levels? Is there anything out there that instead of, like, I'm not saying instead of, but are there standard tests that you could do, blood tests that you could do that would check to see if a patient's off?
So I'm not a medical professional, so I would have a hard time answering that one. I mean, I know kind of been around psychiatrists, and I know they order panels to check levels and things, but I also know that has to do with trying to figure out medications as well. But you may be able to answer.
A standard screen of, you know, thyroid, cortisol levels, testosterone levels, hormone levels, just kind of seeing where someone is at a baseline. Because they could come in to see you and just be really fatigued and they feel really depressed and you check their labs and they've got a thyroid dysfunction.
Okay.
In which case, instead of treating the symptom of the fatigue and the depression, we found the root, we treat the root, and then
yeah.
the side effects get better. But as far as a magic screen, not really.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think they do screens because I think the levels tell them so much.
Right.
And so they
right.
want to rule stuff out before
yes.
they then commit
go
to a diagnosis
right.
of
exactly.
some sort. So I think that's very helpful. I do know that there's procedures and tests out there that can let you know what medications work best
yes.
with you, what
mm-hmm.
they call a gene site testing.
Mm-hmm.
So they can actually do a swab and find out how you genetically metabolize medications and kind of tell you which ones are going to work better.
Now,
so.
Do you find doctors are familiar with those tools
that's
and utilize them more?
That's mostly through psychiatrists.
Okay.
So that's
yeah.
a lot of times where we'll send to psychiatry, because I've had that patient that's been on 3 or 4 medications and we just can't figure it out. We'll go to psychiatry and a lot of times they'll do the swab. And it's really interesting. It comes back in a red, yellow, green range, and green is what you respond best to. Yellow is a, try it if you want to. Red is you're not, it's not going to work for you.
Okay.
And it's interesting when you see that come back on a patient and go, well, duh, these four that we tried that we failed are all in the reds. So we need to try something in the green.
And that's not to say that every patient needs that, because a lot of times you're going to start on some of the more mild.
Yes. Yeah.
This is more for complicated cases, right. I think. Right. So those are definitely out there. Let's kind of talk about children, because, you know, we've talked a lot about adults and we've talked about young adults, but now we're dealing with children, and we're seeing coming out of the pandemic, we're getting more mental health crisis than ever before. And what, 20% of children, adolescents have some sort of mental health diagnosis. And we know it's the second leading cause of death for 10 to 24 year olds. I mean, we're talking 10 years old, and I've worked at a medical facility, and seeing a child come in that young, ugh, you know, with a suicide attempt is something that's completely heartbreaking.
I have two 10-year-olds. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, and it is. And we know there's a shortage of a place to send people for mental health care, you know, and that's the hardest thing, is because now we have one out of eight in every ER room is coming in with a mental health or substance use disorder. There's not enough hospitals. There's not enough treatment facilities. There's not enough counselors and psychiatrists. So that's a struggle in and of itself. How are y'all managing that with your own protocol and how you're helping people get help?
Kids are hard. It really is. And especially when it comes to mental health, not only because, like you said, there's not the resources, and the resources we do have, unfortunately, aren't the best because they're not well supported. Mm. So we have several places that we can send people for inpatient therapy, but especially in this area, the handful we have, the government support to them is just not there, so they're not quality places. So they end up coming out worse than they were when they went in. Plus, put in the fact that insurance doesn't cover mental health. I mean, it doesn't cover the counselors. And if you call your insurance company, and the list of counselors they do cover that they give you are usually tele, and it's just not the quality that you're looking for. It's not your around the corner wants to sit down with you, really get to the base of why you feel this way, and bring those feelings up and help you manage how to move forward with them. They're the ones that want to send you psychiatrists and get you on medications, and so we really need to push in the medical field more coverage for mental health in the insurance fields.
Yeah, and I think, you know, coming from a therapist who takes insurance and tries to help people make sure they have access to care, because it's not easy taking insurance. I can tell you, I spend a lot of hours trying to make sure my patients are covered and making sure. And you know, counselors aren't getting wealthy off of insurance payments. So, you know, that's what I'm hearing from therapists, is it's so hard to manage that process, that even though they want to give people that relief, that we have to find a way to make sure the process is easier.
Absolutely, because I would say probably 6 out of 10 patients don't go to therapy because of the cost.
Yes.
Because Lauren, I just can't afford it. Can't afford the $120 a week or the $160 a week.
100%.
And so they're not seeking help.
And yeah, and money's tight right now. It's not easy. And so you have to find ways to cut. And one way to do that is to use your insurance.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's where you have to really work with therapists. And I know there's a lot of therapists out there that, you know, if they take insurance, they're going to work with you. They're going to try to help you through that. And so, because, I mean, ultimately, I would say majority of therapists want to be doing that job, and they want to be helping people.
Absolutely.
That's why they got in that field to begin with. There's just a lot of barriers when it comes to insurance.
Lots of barriers, yes, absolutely. And then, like you said, it's a lot of back work on your side.
Yes.
And then also the patient. Then you have to take your bill and you have to submit it and get it
through. Well, that's where you find a lot of therapists just don't accept insurance.
Exactly.
Yes. They're like, you can file it on your own, get reimbursement, and then that overwhelms a patient, especially if they're mentally struggling.
Yes.
You know, it's like, I'm not doing this. It's too much. I'm overwhelmed, right?
Yeah.
And so, absolutely, the resources need to be there for sure.
Agreed. Yeah, and that's where I think that we as a whole in our profession, as medical professionals and mental health professionals, can work together. I do think that that's really important in building those referral systems.
Yes, absolutely.
So when you're seeing these younger patients come in, like Carla was talking about, what are some of the things they're sharing with you that are stressors that you feel like are contributing to their mental well-being? Mental well-being.
Yeah, that's good, Brandy.
Yeah, thank you.
Mental well-beingness, I liked it.
Cut.
where are the those crickets.
Where are those crickets? That's right. That's what we need.
I make up words on a daily basis. A lot of it is body image.
Oh, wow.
There's
okay.
so much.
Lots of body image.
Yes. I mean, even looking back at pictures, and I'm not old, I'm 38, but even looking at pictures from when I was in elementary and middle school, I mean, I was not a looker. I mean, we're talking curly hair, big bangs, rolled both ways. Yeah. I mean, it was just, but you know, you feel confident in the moment.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's, not that it's completely different then versus now, but I think now there's such a push early on for
the
these girls.
Social media.
Yes. It is. I mean, I have a 10-year-old that's asking to shave her legs. Like, no, we're not there yet, but she's having.
You're like, one day you'll thank me, honey, yes. for not making you shave yes. your legs this early, you know?
But she unfortunately has very dark hair on her legs, so she has friends at school poking fun at her because her leg hair is dark.
Yeah.
I don't need my 10-year-old worrying about dark hair on her legs. I mean, she needs to be worried about what friend she's going to go riding a bike with after school.
Right.
You know, but we do have so many, unfortunately, younger kids that are exposed to iPhones. And to parents that aren't as present as they used to be, because now we have social media parenting our children instead of parents. Plus video games and TV and commercials.
And parents are having to work two jobs. Yes. Like both parents are having to work to make ends meet, which means that kids are exposed to so much more. You think about, you know, back a long time ago, and we don't want to age ourselves by any means, but there wasn't internet access before. And so right now the kids are having at their fingertips
everything.
Instant. Things that are so
instant.
And they're not developmentally ready for what they're seeing, right?
Heck, we're not. Some of the stuff we see now, we're not ready for, right?
100%.
So, and we have smart tablets and phones being shoved in young kids' hands. And so I read a, I wish I could remember who the quote was by, but a little girl asked a dad a deep question. And she said, well, Daddy, what does this mean or what is this? And he stood up and said, they were on a train. And he stood up and said, well, baby, can you pick up my suitcase? Can you carry it off the train for me? And she said, well, I can't, Daddy. It's too heavy. She said, okay, then I'll carry it for you. And he said, a lot of information is that way of allow me to carry it for you until you're ready to carry the heaviness of that information.
Yeah.
And that's, I feel like, how we used to be before social media and smartphones were so involved, because now our kids can get online and look up anything.
They don't need us. Yeah.
And so instead of choosing the weight of the knowledge that our kids get to carry around, it's being thrown at them from all angles.
Yeah, and the parents are like, you know, they come to you after a child makes an attempt, and they're like, we didn't know.
Yes.
We didn't know. Well, part of it is that, is that kids aren't asking parents anymore. They're asking their tablets, right? Yeah. They're asking their friends and their tablets, and they're not talking to their parents anymore.
And their brains aren't developed enough to hold that kind of information and understand it and process it.
Yeah,
so 100%. Instead of being a 10-year-old, you're all of a sudden a 10-year-old that your friends think are ugly because you got hair in your legs. I mean, it's just, it doesn't commute. It just doesn't.
And I think we as adults, we need to remind ourselves that what are small to us are big to them.
Yes.
That's important, Brandy. That's really important.
What is small to us is big to them.
Absolutely.
And they see that. They see that, and I think that that's one thing, as parents, we need to be more involved. These kids, believe it or not, more than we want or we realize, they want us to come to them and go, what are you doing? What are you looking at? Mm-hmm. What are you watching on TV? You know, we get so used to, like you said, two jobs, you're tired, you got to cook dinner, you got to do laundry. And those that should be our priority have fallen to the side sometimes. And I think we need to remind ourselves that this is so important. This is the future of our nation.
The kids may push back, but they really thrive on having those boundaries. Yeah. They really want those boundaries, you know. How many kids come in my office and say, well, I can do whatever I want. My parents don't care. They don't care. They're not checking on me, you know. And so that's true. And in the parents' defense, they are tired. They are busy. Yeah. They are doing all these things.
Sure.
But it is so important to find that balance, you know, to make sure that we're really aware of what our kids are getting into. Mm-hmm. Yeah, such important fact.
We want to thank you, Lauren, for being our guest today. And if there's one thing that the audience can walk away with, what's something you'd want them to know or changes that you want to see?
I want to break the stigma on mental health. I want to make it something we talk about, something that's out there, that's we have more commercials on. I mean, on social media, let's make a push towards bringing darkness out of darkness and bring it to the light. together.
I love that so much. And that's exactly what we're trying to do here at Mental Park. And for any of you guys out there who are listening, who are struggling, please listen to what we have said today. There is help. There's ways that you can feel better. Please reach out to your doctor, your mental health professional, a trusted friend, relative, somebody. Let someone know that you're struggling so that we can get you connected with the proper help. If you are having suicidal or self-harm thoughts, we need you to go to the nearest ER. We need you to call 911. And if you don't have any other resources, please reach out to the National Suicide Hotline at 988. Again, we want to thank you so much for tuning in to The Mental Perk, where we talk about with real people about real issues with real talk. We want to make sure that you guys out there realize that mental health is so important and that you are not alone in this. We want to make sure everyone knows you matter. You're never alone.